This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. We have a little bit of time-sensitive information we'd like to share with you here this week. Michael Lamar had contacted me and told me about an opportunity that he is looking for a couple of instructors to teach magic at their Discover Magic program. You can find out more information about this at the discovermagic.com website, and they currently have about 52 instructors, but they have room for two more, and the open enrollment's going to be between October the 14th and the 28th. So if you have some interest about teaching youth, that is between 8 and 12-year-olds approximately, they have a lot of information on the website that they can help you design this class in order to be successful in your area and perhaps get an exclusive. So first couple of people get in will get a pretty good opportunity here to work with Michael Marr and a couple of other top pros to teach magic in your area also. But before we get started talking about that, Michael and I talk a little bit about a variety of other things. Particularly, he's got a new trick that is out along with Losander that's called Exquisite, which basically is a floating, kind of an impromptu way of floating a wine glass. I say impromptu, yeah, there's a gimmick involved, but it's something that you can carry with you easily enough and do in a surrounding strolling environment. I'm impressed with it. I bought two of them, and so I have certainly bought into this. I think it's a pretty cool little idea. But beyond that, you know, we get to talk about what Michael's been doing and how that lectures have changed over the years, as well as working cruise ships. Oh, gosh, a variety of things. You're going to be in for a pretty good treat here this week as we get to hear Michael Lamar. And let me also encourage you, if you haven't already gone over to our Facebook page, please like us over there on facebook.com/TheMagicWordPodcast. There you can like our page and you can follow us and find out what's going to be happening from week to week, because we've got a lot of great things that are lined up over the next few weeks, and I will be posting those and letting you know a little bit beforehand, so this way that you can anticipate some of the great podcasts that we've got coming up and some of the performers and magicians who are going to be featured on the podcast. So, right now, please welcome Michael Lamar here on The Magic Word.
Great. Anytime you want to officially start, I'm good to go.
All right. Hello. This is Scott Wells for TheMagicWordPodcast.com, and that voice you hear is Michael Lamar. Hi there, Michael.
Hi, Scott. Always a pleasure.
Indeed, mine as well. It's been a while. I saw you at Magic Live earlier this year, and you're working in the booth over there with Losander. And you just happen to be hanging out over there, or because of the
yes,
new product?
Actually, or? Yeah. Well, at that particular moment, I was over with Dirk. We are releasing, you know, a wonderful new effect called Exquisite. Mm-hmm. You got to see it performed, didn't you?
There, and in fact, I bought two of them.
a true professional. And you know, it's the kind of thing that I was saying to Dirk that we should probably have a package deal for guys that want to buy two, because most professionals will say, you know, I want two of them. Mm-hmm. Now, what you got there at Magic Live was a part of a batch that Dirk made by hand, mm-hmm. each one of those pieces. And, you know, he has such experience with the tables and the woodworking and stuff, right?
Right.
And so that little thing that attached to the glass was a handmade little piece of wood that Dirk, you know, made, and then put some cloth tape on for a little texture and stuff. Now, when it comes to manufacturing that and producing that in quantity, that little piece of wood was going to be outrageously expensive because each piece had to be cut by hand and sanded and drilled and prepared, you know, each piece.
Right. Each one custom, not custom, but handmade, certainly. And yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And there was no kind of way to just program that into a thing that would spit these out. Mm-hmm. And actually, there's a chance for the wood grain to split. Mm-hmm. If you have a really heavy glass, if you've decided to put liquid in it and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So we have taken that to the next levels with this 3D printing device. You know, so we've managed to make that a really official, well-designed thing that has a nice rubber coating. And it just added 6 weeks to the manufacturing mm-hmm. and the release of it. And so the official release is going to be about 3 weeks okay. from now, and a couple of weeks by the time this airs. And you know what? I tell you, I just love this thing.
I really do, too. Obviously, that's why I bought two of them. I really think that it's great. It's something I can use in a walk-around situation. I do a lot of cocktail parties, and it is something – basically, the effect is, for those listening and wondering what the heck you two guys talking about, is a floating wine glass. You know, if it has Dirk's name on it or Losander's name, you know that it's going to have something to do with floating. But this is something in which that it's more organic, I guess.
I had played with this idea for quite a while, actually, you know, maybe 15 years, and had a couple of different gimmicks that would grab the glass at its where the stem meets the bowl of the glass, mm-hmm. right, kind of scoops in from underneath. And now when you have a flat top on a glass or a table or something like that, it's different than when you have a round ball like a zombie. The round ball, you can't tell whether or not it's articulating or moving around the way you can with a flat top table. And see, with a table, when Dirk floats that, you can tell that the table is staying flat no matter how his hands move and how he moves around and
sure.
really conveys independent movement. And you have that with the glass as well, that they can tell that the glass is staying flat, even though your hands are moving all around it. Now, that articulating thing that gets it to do that, I was having trouble with that specific attachment. And I went to Dirk with this 3 years ago, saying to me, can you figure out a way to make this stay flat a little better? And, you know, after he played with it a while, he says, you know, have you ever considered clipping the glass at the top, you know, and I always assured that this was a terrible idea, that really the key to getting this thing securely and quickly and all that was this way that I'd been doing it.
Right.
And, you know, fortunately he was stuck on the idea and felt like this was really, you know, what it was he had years ago a zombie, you know, the typical zombie gimmick with the cork in the bottom of the ball, right?
Sure, sure.
He thought, what if you attached it at the top? And he had a magnet at the top. And so one of his early claims to fame was this zombie where he could kind of show that it's not being attached from the bottom. And this fooled everybody. You know, it's like, wow, how could he possibly be attached? We can see the bottom of the ball here. And that had been in the back of his mind all these years, that, you know, clipping it from the top is a really clever way to attach. And this little way of picking it up there is just so clever and so much better, frankly, than the other method, that as soon as I saw it, okay, this is the way to do it.
Yeah, this works.
Yeah, and it allows you to do that wonderful moment that Dirk has in his floating table, where the spectator is holding two of the corners and you're holding two of the corners, and you both get to lift mm-hmm. and look underneath, and you see the bottom part of all that stuff and the bottom part of the glass and everything, and it just looks amazing.
It does. It's kind of like his floating table done close up in an improvisation or impromptu way in a surrounded environment with cocktail glass, basically.
And the basic concept, that zombie sort of attachment, is so deceptive. And, you know, he has spent years also with the shape of that gimmick. you know, that little U at the end, mm-hmm. and then that curve that it's got, you're able to get so much movement without having to move your hands. That's what makes it look so amazing. You know, this thing floats up like 15 inches, and it looks like you don't move at all.
Yeah.
And then it freezes, and then you get to move around, and it's like, wow, you know. Now, I talked to Dirk just Saturday. He's closing. He's on the cruise ships now, right?
Right, yeah.
He closes his cruise ship act with the floating glass now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. Isn't that wild? So
yeah, because I'd contacted him when I wanted to get this second backup that he said he was on the cruise ship, and he said, I've got one I'm using, and I got an extra one. I'll shoot it to you. So
You got lucky because he doesn't have that all that stuff with him on the ship. And that's also affected kind of our production schedule a little bit because, you know, we had to really work around the fact that he's only on land like 4 hours a week.
Yeah. Why did you end up calling it Exquisite? When you asked when we were Magic Live, I said you got an idea, and I kind of like the name Crystal Air.
So I liked Crystal Air as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I was, in fact, that was my choice right up until, you know, the last minute. And we basically felt crunched to make a decision so that we could get the ball rolling.
Sure.
And, but I thought Crystal Air worked on several levels. Mm-hmm. I thought it was classy. It had that kind of an airline kind of
right.
flying thing with it. So for something that you came up with pretty spontaneously, I thought that was a great option. Yeah, and because I even said to Dirk, you know, I tend to not like names where you have no idea what the effect is.
Yeah.
You know, an Exquisite is one of those names that, like, yeah, I don't know what that really means. It's, well, it's Exquisite. What can I tell you? You know, but so, yeah, I'm breaking one of my own kind of pet peeves.
Well, speaking of cruises, and I know that he's out on one then right now, have you worked many cruises and in the past? And if so, has it been like close-up, stand-up?
You know, I did some cruise stuff back in the 80s, which was truly a different era mm-hmm. for the cruise ships.
Was that when Ron Wilson was booking?
Yeah, and the even the nature of that industry is different now than it was then. There were kind of older ships, you know, the facilities weren't great, but it was a captive audience. And yet these days, and at the time I thought, you know, when I retire someday, maybe I'll want to do something like this. It just wasn't
right.
What I was interested in at the time. But these days, the cruise industry is such a big part of our market. It's one of the last places where huge groups of people all sit down and watch a live performance
right.
all at the same time. They have some of the best facilities of anywhere in the world, are those stage facilities now that you get, you know, because there's so few theaters in other places although I'm not really working cruises now, I would look at that as one of the most legitimate performance outlets out there these
but
days.
When you were doing it, were you doing a lot of close-up? In the 80s, you were really known as a close-up guy. I mean, I know, like, a Dove and Balloon and some other kinds of things that you had were stand-up kinds of things that would play for those larger audiences up to 1,000 people or so, but did you have that kind of an act that would play to a larger audience?
No, not really. In the 80s, people really saw stage as different than close-up.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, these days, surprisingly, you know, you're starting to see more close-up done on stage.
Well, with the image magnifiers and...
Yeah, and the fact that you can see what's going on so much better. But it's also kind of a mindset. I remember in the late 80s being out in Hollywood and trying to sell the idea of a close-up television special. And my premise at the time was, that, you know, when Copperfield is on television, a quarter is the same size as that Statue of Liberty, you know, when the
right.
When they do a close-up, it's all the same size, you know, and why not just do those? I said, you know, look at some of the most popular segments of all these grand illusion shows are the close-up. And
you remember Doug Henning, in his very first television special, he opened with John Cornelius' Vanishing Nickel.
The Vanishing Nickel, you know, and what a lesson that was.
But
the problem was, what I was doing at the time was going to these guys and saying, hey, here's a new idea. Here's something that's never been done before. Hey, why not do this sleight of hand stuff on television? And what I learned was that nobody, all these guys in Hollywood that feel like they're one bad decision away from losing their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so nobody wants to be the guy that tries something completely new.
They'd rather do something formulaic that's already worked.
Exactly. It was the total wrong pitch. If I'd have just taken the idea that here's something that's absolutely slam dunk, it's worked over and over again, we're just going to change a little bit of it, mm-hmm. you know, to make it seem new, that would have been more compelling to these guys. But the idea of, and it took me years to figure that out. Okay,
yeah.
Nobody wants to be the first guy that does this stuff. Oh, now I get it.
Now, was this about the time when you had been on television, like with Johnny Carson?
Mm-hmm. This is 86, 87, and 88. And, yeah, that was a time when I was able to do talk shows. You know, I found out that they love having somebody come on and do 5 or 6 or 7 minutes that isn't pitching a movie or
right.
holding up a book or something like
variety.
That. They actually need content. And if they can depend on you as somebody that can deliver the goods, you can become a regular on these shows.
Like Kreskin was, or Amazing Randy.
Exactly. And, you know, even and Jason Randall several years ago fell into that position on the Letterman show. You know, he did 8 or 9 of the Letterman shows.
Yeah.
At a time when I, you know, and, you know, it was interesting. Some people, you know, when he was on that Magic Week with myself and Johnny Ace Palmer and John Carney and
Steve Cohen.
And, you know, together we did this, you know, week of magic on the Letterman show.
That was great.
And Jason was first. Mm-hmm. And I heard some people say, hey, it looked like he went to the magic shop right before the show. And it's like, you know, if you were doing your 9th appearance on one of these shows, you know, in a 3-year period of time, you'd be going to the magic shop yourself.
Yeah, he wants something new.
Not that many people have. I mean, it's like make a list of your 3 tricks that you'd do, you know, if you're going to go on. And then they call you 6 weeks later and say, we want you again. And you make your list of things you could do and say, well, but I can't do that and I can't do that. You know, by the 2nd or 3rd time that you're going through your repertoire, you start to realize not that many things are just right for that venue.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody would be, you know, scrambling after a few appearances. You know, so it's not as easy as people think.
Well, you had, if you'll tell a story, as I recall, where you were supposed to be floating a dollar bill on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson and had some problem.
Yeah, that was the Will Schreiner show.
Oh, was that one? Okay.
Yeah, it was the Will Schreiner show. But as I look at the Tonight Show now, as several things that I did on those shows at the time, I am just amazed at the chances that I took. I just
well, you were younger.
I cannot believe it. I mean, with the Tonight Show, that the whole opening segment, I was hooked up with this thread, and I didn't have a backup thread.
Yeah.
And where would you have gone, you know? But the one time I did end up breaking the thread and not being able to do the trick. Thank goodness I had a thumb tip, and ready to go into it. Yeah, it's interesting. If I were to go into that whole sort of thing for another round of interest in that, what I would approach it completely different. I wouldn't look at my current repertoire and say, which of my tricks am I currently doing would work there. I would look at that venue and say, what's right for that venue? Let me develop something that makes sense for that host and that situation and that context that you're in, that kind of thing. But to work backwards from the venue to create the material, not work from your repertoire and try and squeeze that into the venue. So many people, when they're trying to figure out where am I going to work, if you loved magic and you developed a repertoire and you learned a bunch of tricks and at some point you said, I should try and do this for a living. Where can I do these things that I've learned? You'll probably have a hard time finding the right venue. But if you decide on your venue first and then develop your repertoire based on what your venues are likely to be, you'll probably come up with a different repertoire.
That's a different way of looking at it, Michael. I hadn't thought about that. Certainly most people, it seems like, have tricks that they learn because they're interested in whatever it might be. It could be doves, could be illusions, could be coins or mentalism, whatever it is. And then they try to find some place to work it. And you're suggesting the other way around.
The opposite approach is so much more efficient. The material that the average guy ends up learning is just so randomly stumbled upon.
That's true.
It's what's currently being demoed at the shop or online or what they saw their friends do. But the odds that that's going to really fit your ultimate venue are really slim. Where you're going to work has so much criteria attached to it that, working backwards from that is 10 times more effective.
Well, I remember you saying so many years ago when you were still back in Bluefield, Virginia, or was it West Virginia or Virginia?
West Virginia,
yeah. That you were working senior citizens' homes just for experience.
As I look at it now, that's probably a really legitimate marketplace out there that very few people are working. What happened for me was they wanted family nights, one night a week at each of these nursing homes. And there was four of them in my town under the same kind of banner, And they hired me to come into each one of them one night a month. So I did it every Wednesday night. It wasn't for the senior citizen, it was for their families. So they bring the grandkids, bring the families to visit the residents. And
right.
What a great idea that was.
Good way of encouraging all the kids to come and see the grandparents.
Exactly. Exactly. What a cheap way to get, the whole family together.
So you didn't see yourself as a children's entertainer, but more of a family entertainer.
But at that time, I was willing to go anywhere somebody wanted to see magic, whether it was a birthday party or a school show or anything. And
that's good advice, I think, for anybody getting into magic, looking for a venue. Just do anything.
Right, and find what appeals to you. If it's easy to think, well, the school market is really a great market, but you really. It's kind of a marathon. That's an endurance job. You have to be glad you got four of those shows today. Kind of a working attitude, as opposed to a private party or a corporate event or something like that. Doing them to a certain extent really helps you find what you want to do. I wasn't doing enough of those to really be good at it, and so ultimately I said, I've got to really start focusing on the things that I want to excel at, and started cutting back on my repertoire.
And in that regard, that's when you started to finally hone what it was that interested you the most. And at that time, what was it? Was it cars?
Yeah, that's well, or close up in general. I didn't want to specialize in cards. I wanted it to have some texture, but I felt like the upside earning potential was better for some of the corporate stuff. That there was a chance to earn $2,000 or $3,000 in a single show, where it'd take me 10 school shows to make that.
Sure. And you can quickly do the numbers on that.
The upside potential was better for corporate stuff at the time.
So you crossed the nation and came to Los Angeles and to work with Di Vernon. Had you just read about him, heard about him, or why did you decide to go and hang out and learn from him?
Well, part of it is, I think, growing up in West Virginia, I knew I was far from the Magic Center and the Magic Castle and where all these things were happening. And so I always felt like, boy, if I could just be out there, where it's all happening, what a difference it would make. And, so to have that sabbatical to go out and be at the Magic Castle seemed like such an important part of it. But really, being isolated there in West Virginia long enough gave me time to develop my own style and my own point of view and my own, sense of what it should be about or what appealed to me. I think that having that chance to develop, out of the limelight or out of the
out of the mainstream of magic, there weren't a lot of other magicians around you. I mean, you and Gary Plants were probably about it.
If you were out at the Magic Castle, also you would have said to yourself, I don't want to do the Linking Rings. Everybody here seems to know the Linking Rings and sponge balls. Everybody does sponge balls. But in West Virginia, I never ran into any of that. Why not do all the classics? Because they're all new here.
Yeah. So everybody was saying you're the best magician I've ever seen.
And
not a great compliment.
The idea that somebody else might do a routine that I'm doing, it didn't bother me at all. I mean, it was interesting to see if they agreed that this was a good way to approach it. So I never felt that sense of scarcity or I've got to protect what I do and make sure nobody else says this the way that I say it. I was flattered when people would want to do something that I was doing. And so I was eager to share and felt no sense of what if somebody else sees them doing that trick first? So it did develop a certain attitude to have grown up outside of the mainstream of magic. But I would get these magazines and I would see these conventions and I would read about these people and I'm going to go to this convention. I'm going to meet this guy. So I was aware of the professor and had traveled and met him at conventions starting in 77 and 78, which is really early in my career.
Yeah.
And when I would go to these conventions, I would make a point of finding this guy and hanging out there and a lot. And eventually, these guys notice it and they ask you to do a trick for them. Slowly I got to, it's astonishing to me, but slowly I got to know the guy after just a couple of years of running into him at conventions.
Because you always approached him rather than kind of standing back.
I was always he'd turn around and kind of bump into me. Oh, there you are again,
You were just like right out of college. You were basically, around 21 or 2 or so?
Yep. Mm-hmm. And I really, looking back on it, it's kind of funny, but I just would hang around and listen and if they would make any comments, I'd make a point of the next time I saw them, showing them that I listened to what they said and I took it into account, and here's what I've come up with based on that. And after two or three times of doing this, wow, okay, so you're not going away, are you? No.
So is that advice you would pass on then to younger people today, going to conventions and hanging out and actually listening to these guys and not just buying their trick of the day, but to actually listen to what's behind the magic?
I said, you know, it's an incredible opportunity to go straight to the top of your industries. I mean, the idea that you can have somebody basically even come to your own town,
yeah,
and talk to a group of 10 or 20 or 30 of you and demonstrate this stuff. I mean, if you ask the right questions, it's truly incredible.
It is unique art from that standpoint, because if you look at any other art, let's say like a musician, I mean, you wouldn't go up and ask Frank Sinatra for a couple of pointers, you know, back in his day or something.
You could. Now, what other industry can you literally go up and just carry on a conversation with the top people in their industry and have them actually be flattered that you're interested enough and that you care enough to ask some of these questions? It's a rare situation that we have.
I think a lot of people, young people in particular, are a little bit reticent to do that because that they feel like that it may be inappropriate, or they don't think they're going to ask the right question, or might be embarrassed or something. But I would encourage them to go and do it, because that's part of what this podcast is about, of trying to show that the people who I talk with, who are the top pros, such as yourself, are regular people who will engage with others and glad to share ideas. So this way the next generation is even better.
Yeah, we don't have so many that it's, you know, something we lock ourselves away from. I mean, we're excited to see somebody interested in the things that interest us.
Right.
And I always felt like, you know, the quality of your life is affected by the quality of the questions that you ask yourself and that you ask of other people. Even if you're not answering, the answers are less important than asking the right questions.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's, you know, opportunities that, you know, are almost unique to the world of magic.
Well, what were some of the questions, or maybe a better question would be, what were some of the answers that Divernant had given you, or more specifically, what would have been your one or two or three biggest stories or takeaways from being around Divernant that you still live by today?
Well, you know, one of the things that, well, you know, when I first talked to you, I was given the cups and balls lesson earlier today.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we were talking about was some of the wand moves that the professor shared with me. And something that I learned while trying to learn the Vernon wand spin has led to just an offhand remark from the professor, but it was a real lesson that influenced a lot in my approach. But I had learned the wand spin wrong. And when I showed it to him, he goes, "Oh, what is that?" I go, "Well, that's the wand spin." He goes, "No, don't be ridiculous." And when I got it right out of the book, he goes, no, it's all wrong in the book, you know? and I, oh man, it was so hard to learn. He goes, "Yeah." And he says, "This is important, you know," and he really seized on this. He goes, "You must thoroughly understand before you rehearse, or you're just hurting yourself. You know, if you don't understand and you practice, you know, you're not making it perfect if you don't understand what you're practicing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're just ingraining bad habits." And, you know, he says, practice doesn't make perfect. It makes permanent. And if you're not learning the right thing, you actually are hurting yourself every time you practice. So you must thoroughly understand first. And it made me realize just how often that first communication of what to do hasn't been understood. And this person goes on to try and work on that and develop it. And because they didn't get the first handoff of the information, you know, there they go. And now they're practicing the wrong thing. And so this curriculum that I've been working on, the Discover Magic curriculum, for children 8 to 12 years old, we communicate some of the information, and then the kids break into sessions to rehearse while their rehearsals are being chaperoned and facilitated. And the point there is to make sure that they actually understood the point in the first place. You know, how many of these classes I've seen where the guys make the class time just communicating the information. Here's another trick, and here's how it's done. Here's another trick, here's how it's done. And, you know, they're supposed to go home and rehearse. And it's like, wow, if they don't rehearse until they get home, the odds are slim that they've got the right, that they're going out of here able to do it.
Now, a classroom situation is different from a lecture situation. It's more of a workshop.
Yes, okay. Yes. Now, you know, a lecture is almost a show, and that the explanations actually have to be as interesting and entertaining as the performance. And you want to cover a lot of stuff so that they have a chance to choose, and, you know, from a range of things to the stuff they're going to work on. But in a workshop or something like Discover Magic, we want them to really learn the things that we're covering at the moment. And so you cover less.
But detail and depth.
But you really make sure that they understand it and how to go into it and how to come out of it and that sort of thing. So,
you know, there are a lot of people, a lot of magicians around the world who are lecturing or want to lecture and may not necessarily be good at it or wanting to get into it and want to do it right. Correctly from the start. And you being one of the best magic teachers in the world, certainly, and with your expertise, I know that you have finally refined and honed this down to a real art. What would you give advice, or what would you suggest to others who are wanting to lecture and teach magic? I mean, is there a some sort of a of an outline, or?
Well, you know, it's evolved since I first started doing it. You know, when I first started getting into magic lectures, if you wanted to see a guy do a move, you had to be in the room when he did it, or you didn't get to see that move. And otherwise, it's in print. Maybe you can figure it out from print, but it might be a challenge. So when a guy came to your town to do a lecture, it was a big deal. It was like a rare opportunity to see this stuff. Okay, and now 10 or 12 years ago, I went to South Korea to lecture at a festival. And right away, when I would see these guys, they would say, oh, I've seen all your videos. Oh, I've seen all your... And eventually I said, you know, I've done a lot of videos. Are you sure you've seen them all? And they go, oh, yes, it's all of it's online. And at the time, their whole country was a hotspot, like a gigabyte a second Wi-Fi. They're still way ahead of us on the internet, on just that whole bandwidth thing. And everything was online. And so for them to say, I watched all your videos, was truly a compliment, because they could have watched anything. Could have watched anything, but I chose to watch you. All right. And so to them, it really, there was no ethical aspect of it. It was a compliment. But then when I walked out to do the lecture, and I'm looking, and I see a handful of these same guys in the front row, then I start thinking, now, to go back one or two steps before that, back when we first started doing videos as instructionals, the feeling was that video wasn't a good learning medium, that it wasn't good for teaching magic back in the 70s and 80s.
It's back in the VHS days and even right, Beta, I guess, and Stevens Magic Emporium.
This just doesn't do the job right. And so my challenge was, well, what if you scripted the explanations and you used the medium and you have like see-through cards and glass table and, you know, let's make our goal be to make the video explanation better than live, better than any live explanation could possibly be. And let's see what they say to that.
Yeah, right? Don't just stick a camera on it. Actually do something and make
let's
use of it.
Let's really think, how can this medium communicate this? Mm-hmm. And if you do it right, it should be able to do it better. It's over the shoulder. It's slow motion. How can this not be better than live, right? And so, and every time we would go back to the do another project, okay, how can we make this better than live? And how can we? So now in Korea, I hear all these guys say, oh, I've seen all your videos. Then I walk out to do the lecture and I'm standing at it and I realize, oh my gosh, all of these guys have seen all of my better than live explanations. What am I doing here?
Yeah.
What am I doing here? This, I now realize that any of them can watch any of the explanations anytime they want. Mm-hmm. So the challenge becomes, how do you make that live lecture better than the better than live explanations? And the answer is, it has to be something different, essentially. You know, it can't just be communicate the information. There has to be something more to the experience, because at this stage of the game, they can watch all the how to win. We've changed. It's not the bottleneck, isn't access to the information anymore. We all have access to all of it. The bottleneck now is, you know, efficiency and effectiveness. You know, how can I more efficiently see more information? How can I more effectively learn what I need to learn? And so I always feel, every time I stand in front of them to do a lecture, I have to say to myself, okay, it has to be more than just the information.
Is it the interactivity then, perhaps, so that you're breaking that fourth wall?
You have to. They can't do that on YouTube.
Right.
You know, you have to do something that can't do. You have to really touch them. You have to really listen to them. You have to really make the performance dynamic. And the same is true of a performance. The performance, people can watch your shows or just about anything they want, anytime they want. Mm-hmm. Even the live performance has to be more than just watch me, because they can just watch anything. You know, there was a day back in when magicians were in every hotel in Las Vegas, and you could go watch these amazing spectaculars. But today, the highest paid entertainer in Las Vegas is a DJ.
Wow.
You know, and it's because these DJs are making $40 and $50 million a piece. And one guy up there with his sound system and his, and it's because it's an experience. Everybody in the club is part of the experience.
And so each night it's different, I guess, depending upon the.
It's a live moment, you know, that you're participating in. But it's not something that you just go to watch as the best option for something to watch tonight.
It's a multi-sensual experience.
Yeah, and that's part of the reason why cruise ships are like amongst the last true venues for a captive audience, because almost nobody, when they're home, decides, I'm going to go out tonight and buy a ticket to see something. Mm-hmm. But since they're on the cruise ship and they're in the middle of the ocean and they're a captive audience, we'll put all of these people in and they'll watch these shows. And it's one of the last places in the world that, you know, you have that dynamic.
Wow. Interesting.
It's really an interesting marketplace these days.
Well, as far as then teaching, I know that you've gone through different iterations, again, going from lectures and then to the videos, the DVDs, and online. And before we began, we were talking briefly about this doctor, I think, in Kansas City that you kind of first
got. Dr. Hydrogen, yes.
Tell me something about that and how that evolved to where it is now.
Yeah, you know, interesting. Boy, I'm spacing out on his name for the moment. There is, he is a scientist that is in Kansas City, and he's in, back in the 70s, he loved magic, and he was in college, and he was going to graduate from college and become a magician. And there was a science competition or something, and that he decided, and he loved science, and so he decided, I'll get in here, and I'll develop a hydrogen-powered car. That would be cool, which he did and won this science. But it turned out to be like the only hydrogen-powered car in the world, and this was a big deal. And so he had to kind of put magic on the back shelf and study and go into science because it only made sense. And so now, years later, he's got all these patents on in different computer technologies and stuff. Roger Billings is his name. Roger Billings, and he had developed a system for self-paced learning by computer that was for math. And what this was if you got the wrong answer, it would understand the nature of your wrong answer, and it would give you the information that you needed to solve that problem better. So it would give you additional information and then retest you until you got that right before it moves you to the next level. It's called the Acelus program. And this was proving to be, this was before the Khan Academy and everything, this was proving to be really effective. And so effective that he wondered if it was possible to do a soft science with this same system. We'll, a self-paced computer learning program. And he wanted to do magic. This was him. He was going to come back and finally do something with magic, with his two passions. And so,
was he kind of using magic to begin with, I guess, to see if this was going to be a model that would work for other kinds of...
That could work in other types of things. Mm-hmm. And so, David Sandy put the two of us together and, to make a long story short, in the end, I felt the thing that was missing was the performance. I felt like the most valuable thing that you can get from learning magic comes from performing it, not from just knowing the secret or knowing the method, and that it was easy to just learn the method, but if you didn't really perform it, you weren't reaping that whole life skills benefits. And I was so committed to that idea that I was like, no, I'm not going to do this with the computer system, but I am going to really drive home this concept for the life skills that magic can teach. But I'm going to incorporate it into a classroom situation so that the kids can perform in class in a certain way so that they get this thing where they actually get to perform it four or five or six times before they leave the class.
Well, magic is a performing art, and so they need to perform. Otherwise, you're just learning it and not doing anything with it.
Exactly. It's just information. It's just data. And really, that all the magic classes that I had seen, you know, were based on teaching stuff in the class and them going home and performing it for their family and friends, which I always thought was like the worst audiences for kids, because they grab the cards or they want to see the stuff. You know, it's really hard. So, and what this ultimately led to was the development of the Discover Magic curriculum. I mean, this thing had percolated in my head for 15 or 20 years before I really met the team that could bring this thing to life, which was Brian Daniel South is the guy that had Creative Magic years ago. If you remember the
I've got some of their things that pops up and
Really, really
very creative,
great clever, practical stuff for the children's entertainers. And
heck, I think even Matt King uses their light tent on his stage.
Yes, he does.
Production of that, surprise.
For the surprise, yes. Right. And which we're respecting here.
Yes.
for those who haven't seen
yeah.
it. So Brian, I met and really understood to be the guy that really understood the nature of the market and the people that perform in it after his years of creative magic. And he turned me on to Michael Rosander, who is out of Wilmington, North Carolina, who has like magic camps for kids during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And really does a great job. You know, Wilmington's a small town, you know, and this guy's running like 200 kids a year through summer magic camps.
Wow.
So he understands that market, and he understands, you know, that kid think. And so I teamed up with these guys to bring this thing to fruition, you know, this curriculum. And really it was Brian and Michael that convinced me that the 8 to 12-year-old is the right target market. For a variety of reasons, it was younger than the market that I was originally targeting, and so their expertise is really important to making this become what it is.
Well, that's a particular age, as I understand it, also that they begin to develop life skills. If they do it a little bit later or a little bit earlier, that they go in different directions and jump from this to that. But that 8 to 12-year-old period is a time which they're more focused, I think.
Yeah, it's like this window of opportunity, similar to learning a language. You know, it was so ironic that Americans just said, you know, we don't want you to learn any foreign language until you're in high school or college, mm-hmm. which is just so the opposite of Europe. I mean,
right.
And now we understand, boy, they absorb it without thinking when they're kids.
Sure.
You know, but once you get to a certain point, it's tougher. That 8 to 12 is they're so open, and parents instinctively understand that. So they invest more in their children development at that 8 to 12 than in the other period. So it works on a number of levels. And so what Discover Magic is in essence, it's a franchise for presenting this class on a local level. And what we've done is it's 8 90-minute classes, and we show you how it can be taught in 5 classes or 10 classes, you know, depending on whatever guy is implementing this on a local level. Again, as you going to have criteria. It's got to fit the summer camp model, or it's got to fit the after school model, or something like that. So different guys are going to be in different positions to offer different, you know, frameworks for the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, this thing has really turned into something fantastic.
Are you talking about this being a magic camp where it's hands-on workshop type of a thing, or is this online or a combination?
No, well, we do utilize some online stuff, but let's say you signed up to be a presenter of Discover Magic there in Houston. What you would get is we have this business building binder that shows you exactly how to create a doing business as, and to find a place to conduct the classes and flyers to promote it and that sort of thing. And we offer the website support, you know, that you can send parents to for testimonials and kids can go there and watch videos that explains what the whole idea is.
Mm-hmm. Promotional thing.
And, mm-hmm. And in every class, they get a top secret file folder with, you know, cool stuff in it and a custom packaged trick. And there's a bonus trick in every class that they go and unlock on the video vault on the website. Kids are given passwords every day for the new content, stuff online. So it's really an interactive thing. And what we do, we look at the magic as like the sugar coating that goes around this little nugget of good information, like the traits of a true magician. You know, right in the middle of the class, there's like a 4-minute video. You know, having experimented with different models over the years, I've realized that if you're live in the class with them, they can only watch so much video before it becomes something that they could do at home. Again, you have to understand the nature of the beast. And 3 or 4 minutes, okay, you can get away with that if you frame it in the right way. Mm-hmm. And we really script that to be the best advice that we can possibly get, because, you know, the kids are just wide open for that. And so we inject that traits of a true magician in there as far as prepared and authentic and you know, creative and that sort of thing. So there's that life skills thing that's right in the middle of every class. And we have this unique system for learning in class where the students pair up and they perform for each other. So, and then they alternate so that each kid gets a chance to perform 5 or 6 times in class for somebody, for a new audience, essentially. So by the time they go home, they actually really know how to do the magic. And
how many tricks are taught?
You guys are already
during the class period. I mean, 3, 4.
Yes.
Okay.
Like 2, maybe 3 tricks in each class. So instead of throwing a lot of information at them,
right,
it's just a little bit, but just enough. And so we launched in April of this year. Our goal was to get 52 presenters inside the first year, and we signed 52. Cities in the first 2 weeks of this, and which was exceeded all our expectations. But we are opening for additional presenters just in this current 2-week period, which is why it's so nice to be able to have a chance to, you know, make this announcement to your listeners at discovermagic.com. They can go and just between October 14th and the 28th, we're going to be taking new presenters. And we only open it for brief periods like that because each guy gets kind of an exclusive territory.
So in other words, if for example, you mentioned me doing this in Houston, then I would have the Houston concession, basically, and no one else would be able to teach your
exactly.
class. Got it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And we want to help them get those, you know, exclusive areas. And there's ways to maintain exclusivity. You know, you have to do a certain number of students a year to maintain an exclusive, you know, if you've got a really prime city or something like that. The business model is such that if I'm signing Evan or Savannah, my kids, up for something like this. The going rate on these things, you know, for 8 classes, it'd be anywhere from $200 to $300 per student. And so if they get a class of 20 kids and they're charging $300 a student for the class, that $6,000 that they would generate from those 8 classes, that's all their money. They get to keep all of that. All they have to do is just buy the materials off of us for each kid, which comes out to $38 a kid, for, you know, the 8 file folders and 8 custom tricks and the online bonus material and stuff like that.
Sounds very reasonable.
Oh, it really is. When you look at it, you go, it's the way we looked at it is somebody like yourself. You've got a library. You could go to the Tarbell course and pull out enough tricks to do a local class. You know, what we say to ourselves is we have to bring so much to the table that any reasonable person would look at that and say, that's way more than I would have done.
Yeah, and why reinvent the wheel when it's already rolling?
You know, why knock myself out? Even if I decided just to steal the tricks that you're teaching and teach them myself, I wouldn't have the props. I wouldn't have the file folder. I wouldn't have the website stuff. I can charge more if I just play the game.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it we knew that it had to make sense for somebody looking at it, intelligent, to say, okay, I can do this and this and this myself. This has to be better. And my golly, we're convinced we've done that. Anybody would look at it and go, okay, that looks great. That looks great. And really, I have to say that, Brian Daniels does such a terrific job at understanding the whole branding thing and making the whole package make sense. And Rosender really knows exactly what he's doing when it comes to presenting things to these kids. So I got lucky.
And again, each of the classes, then, Michael, will last how long? They're 90 minutes apiece for, say, six classes?
Mm-hmm. Eight classes of 90 minutes. But we also teach them how to fluff that into a two-hour classes, if that's what it needed to be.
And when you mentioned the parents, are they invited to come to each of the classes to stay for the period? Or...
No, they could if they wanted to.
Or they can just drop them off.
But they can drop them off. And, we really try to use everything as a learning opportunity. Even with starting the classes, we're going to have like a countdown clock so that the class starts right on time. We're going to teach punctuality. If 8 o'clock is curtain time, then 8 o'clock, the curtain goes up, whether you're here or not, the show must go on, and they can also, when they go home, listen to the, they'll get to see some of the philosophy videos at home and the good advice videos. The kids will be able to, their parents will, we hope their parents will watch some of those because they'll really love those.
What about finding the venue? I would think that would be one of the key issues.
Yes, indeed. And so there's a whole section on how to find the venues and how to, barter to get them free rooms. There's like 30 different ways to find a place to conduct these classes. So we're very happy about, what we've done to set these guys up. And again, I've got to bring these other guys into the picture here. This business building binder turned out to be so much more complete and robust and well thought out than I would have done single-handedly. We kind of push each other to try and think of something else, here's another idea. I got lucky in how that all turned out.
Well, as to the, after they would find the venues, now you're looking for a couple of guys or girls or women to teach these classes over the next, this open enrollment period, if you will. But are these classes to go at the same time nationwide, or are they staggered and you can start them whenever that you wish and back to back?
Each individual presenter will have his own schedule and his own pace for doing things. But we only want to kind of lead people through key parts of the process at the same time. Like these binders that they get are, deluxe custom leather binders that with all the materials included. So they, we only want to kind of go through certain processes, once or twice a year, to set these guys up. So this 2 week period of time will be the only time this year that we'll take
that you're accepting
presenters.
These presenters now. But will the presenters be trained online? I mean, they'll receive these booklets and everything. And what happens?
Yeah, and they get videos explaining exactly how to go through each part of the class and all the material from the class. And they get a lot of all the more support material than you'd think.
Yeah, but theoretically, they could have different classes if they did one in the morning in one part of town and another one in the afternoon somewhere else.
Absolutely, where we feel pretty sure that guys are going to do that. And Daryl was just here visiting a couple of weeks ago, and he wants to do it there in Northern California. So he'll, you know, probably have two classes going on in his town and then a, you know, nearby town. And so that he can, you know, basically what we think guys are going to do is have it twice going on at the same time. So if somebody can't make it to one class, they can make it to another class, you know, in that same week. So, we feel like that sort of overlapping will definitely take place.
Okay. The open enrollment is going to be for a couple week period, and where can they go to sign up, and what are the dates again?
It will be October 14th through October 28th. And go to discovermagic.com, discovermagic.com. You know, and if you have trouble finding that, you know, Brian Daniel South will be fielding those calls and handling the inquiries and that sort of thing. But if anybody's familiar with my stuff, they can come to my site and I can shoot them over to the.
So there's a link also at Michael Amar or AmarMagic.com?
I just realized I'll need to put one there just to be sure.
Okay. All right. Well, again, I thank you very much for doing this and for teaching so many people to become better magicians over the years, and including myself, since we've been friends since 1980.
I vividly remember. We were in Hawaii together, weren't we?
Yes, we were. Yep.
That goes back a ways. You know, and thank you for helping me when I came through Texas a few years ago. You know, I'm in 2016. I'm probably going to begin what will be my final, you know, certainly world tour. Not that I'm retiring.
Yeah.
But
you're way,
you know,
too young to make this your last one. You know,
as I look at this last lecture tour that I did, it took me 7 years to go all the way around and hit all the different places without overlapping. So even if I were to say, I'll tighten that up and I'll make a point of going to, you know, all the places I can, it would take at least 4 years. Mm-hmm. To say and I can fairly safely say, you know, if I did it a dense 4 year run, I'd probably say that's it. I would be willing to do some local things and maybe little mini tours, but the idea of gearing up and going out and doing 25 and 30 cities at a time, I got to tell you, that's a young man's game, kind of. It's a real endurance contest.
Yes.
So I feel like, you know, I've got one more of those in me, one more big push. And after that, I don't know.
Yeah, I understand.
I don't know that I'm going to make a big deal out of saying the last thing, you know, because, but in essence, it probably will be.
Well, a while back, I worked with Lee Earle for his farewell tour, and he's, I think, around 80, so he's definitely saying, yeah, that's my last one. And there were quite a few cities that he made it around to, I want to say 18 or 20 cities that I put him on. Same thing with Aldo Colombini when he went on his farewell tour. You know, who knew that really was seriously going to be his farewell tour?
Exactly.
You know, I just had Jay Sankey on about 18 or 20 cities, and he said, that's about all I really want to do in one compact time period, and he said, I'll be back next year and then finish the back part of the tour for you later, because I could have had him like on 30 different cities or more. So I know there are some people who are more popular, I say, than others, or at least that other groups will want to take. I find that different clubs will want to accept a lecturer for a variety of reasons and not necessarily just because of their budget. It has to do that if they think they're going to be able to at least break even or make money if it's somebody who is a, quote, known name, as opposed to some Joe Blow who might be a great up-and-comer, or maybe someone who is from overseas, but we don't know as well here. And so they, until they see this person, then they realize, wow, that really is a great person, you know. But
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You're a known quantity, so I would think that it would certainly be, if you could make that a tight 3 years for sure.
Yeah, you know, it's still like some of the most fun that I have. I mean, to me, a lecture should be as good as any show. You get the best of both worlds. You get to actually do show stuff, but then you get to talk about how clever this is or how clever that is. And in the end, it should be like as good as any experience that they can have if you do it the right way.
Right.
And to be able to talk about these things to people that care about it, you know, I got to say, I love it, you know, and consider it an honor to be able to do that.
Well, that's why you should never say never, certainly, because it's kind of like a prize fighter who wins and they say, okay, I won this, I'm not going to go back. But then it's just the limelight, the show and everything. I got to go do it again. You know, it's in your blood.
it is. And particularly when you do a bunch of it and you really hit your stride, you really feel like you're doing it well.
Right.
And that feels great.
Well, and you certainly do and have done it well over the years as well. So tell you what, let me wrap up then, Michael. Just I have asked you this in the past, but sometimes the magic word changes. And so what would be your magic word? What is it that's your philosophy of life? As you're getting a little bit older and your children are growing up as well, what's important to you?
Well, you know, at the first part of that question, I had a quick answer, but as you went on, it took on additional meaning. My word of the day was going to be exquisite.
brings it full circle.
but when you really start bringing in, you know, what do things mean, but I do think that we're in an astonishing period of time where, you know, what has worked in the past is so clearly in flux. And over the last 25 years, we've seen comedy clubs come and go. We've seen trade shows come and go, corporate. I mean, it really has been a roller coaster to stay in the industry. And it's been exciting. But you needed to be nimble. And to be willing to work on multiple revenue streams and I got lucky to have a foot in two worlds. You know, I can do the public things and come into the magic world when, you know, other things take a dive. Mm-hmm. It's amazing what's happened, in this, you know, ever changing industry.
So exquisite,
yeah, exquisite. I would have to stick with it because Dirk convinced me that word said a lot when it comes to defining what's happening in this experience. And you know what? I here's my one association with that word. I go back to the Playboy Bunny mansion, the Playboy Mansion. Midsummer Night Dream parties that I used to go to. I was lucky enough to know the plastic surgeon who used to do all the implants for the and he was an amateur magician and would take me to these parties. And I got to meet Tony Curtis at this Midnight Summer's party at the Playboy Mansion. And I did shadow coins for him. You know,
I mean, that's a great trick.
Oh, it was so nice, and it was just such a beautiful, intimate moment. Mm-hmm. And I did this, and he just looks up, and he goes, "That's exquisite." Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow. That was the first time I'd ever, you know, heard anybody actually use that word in a sentence.
Properly. Properly.
And it was like, boy. And so when Dirk missing it, you know, I like that word.
Yeah.
You know, you don't get to use that much in conversations. So. So let's keep
it. Let's do that. And thank you very much. I appreciate it, Michael. I wish you all the best of luck with discovermagic.com. And that project will continue to go on for a long time and, again, teach a lot of magic and to young children who will grow up to be professional magicians and teach
I
others,
hope
too.
So. Yeah. And you keep up the great work yourself.
Well, thank you.
Take care then, Scott.
I appreciate that. And so for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Michael Marr. This is Scotty out. Well, this sounds like a pretty good opportunity for some people to kind of get in on nearly the ground floor of a growing business that could perhaps put some additional money in your pocket and try to create some new magicians who will then perhaps teach other generations in the future as well. And you can be instrumental in helping some young child. Well, this has been just another great opportunity to talk with some friends, and I enjoyed having a chat with my old buddy Michael. We don't get to see each other as often as we'd like, and we both seem to kind of go our own ways and keep pretty busy with our own magical lives. So I hope that you guys will also stay tuned in future weeks. We've got some really great podcasts lined up. So until next time, stay well, get booked, and think about teaching magic. This is Scotty out.